Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. What next? The one thing Americans have long believed they could hold on to was our ingenuity, our creativity. Now comes Newsweek magazine with its headline, The Creativity Crisis, and its report that American kids are losing it, losing the creative spark, and a big report on how to get it back. This hour, On Point, our kids' creativity and the country's future. You can join the conversation. Is creativity still as American as apple pie? If not, why not? Do you think a new creativity space race is on globally? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from San Francisco is Poe Bronson, author and journalist. His article was the cover story in last week's issue of Newsweek. Its headline, The Creativity Crisis. Poe Bronson, welcome back to On Point. Are we losing our spark, Poe?
Well, there's one longitudinal study, the most important study of its kind, that gives us a data point here. It's not conclusive. Usually we look towards corroboration from other studies, but there are none. So we have to look at this one, and this one's by Kyung-hee Kim, a scholar previously with the at University of Georgia, now at College of William and Mary. And she has looked at the long-term trajectory of children's creativity quotient scores taken on the Torrance tests of creative thinking, and which have been given to millions of kids since the 1950s. And by analyzing a very good sample of 300,000 children from the last 10 years and over time, Dr. Kyung-hee Kim has found that creativity scores had been rising as IQ rises until 1990, but since then they have been falling. And the decrease is most significant and most serious for kids from kindergarten through sixth grade.
K to six. Take us in here a little bit. I don't know how you measure creativity. I mean, how does it work? This creativity quotient, everybody knows IQ, but CQ, I'm not so familiar with. How's it work? How do they measure it? And what are
well,
the findings?
Well, I should note, Tom, that when I first saw these tests, I thought, you call that creativity? You know, here I am, a writer. You're a journalist as well. You call that creative excellence? You know, they're tasks that require kids or adult test takers, too, to generate lots of ideas. So they might be given a question such as, imagine that in a blink of an eye, you could transport yourself to anywhere in the world. We all could do this. You have 5 minutes to write down lists of all the problems and all the benefits that could result from this. And so you have to quickly come up with lots of ideas. This is called divergent thinking. Or other tasks where you have to work with your ideas to find the best possible result. And this is called convergent thinking. In creativity tasks, there was no right answer. Many of them are figural. They're drawing-based. We have to come up with lots of ideas for drawings. A lot of them seem to resemble tests of practical intelligence. But what sold me on the tests was not the tests themselves, which I recognize do test idea generativity and idea evaluation. Mm-hmm. But it was the long-term data. Paul Torrance started using these tests on a sample of Minnesota school children in 1958. And he and Garnett Miller followed these school children as they became adults and tracked every accomplishment of their life. For the not everybody made it through the sample all these 50 years, but he continued to track them. And Jonathan Plucker of Indiana University recently reanalyzed Torrance data. And it turns out that childhood creativity index that Torrance came up with predicted lifetime creative achievement at a correlation of 0.60, which is unheard of.
Meaning what? If you got a high score on the creativity quotient, you had a creative career,
life? You turned into the doctors who did a lot of amazing research. You became one of the entrepreneurs who founded companies. You had patents. You became an actor. You wrote books that got published. You became a professor of a university.
So there's some backup that this can actually measure something that turns out to be consequential in life. And when Kyung-hee Kim has gone back and looked at hundreds of thousands of these scores, how significant is the fall off that she's found?
Well, Kyung-hee Kim is working on publishing her data. I and Ashley Merriman, my co-author on this story, are some of the only who actually have actually kind of seen this up close. Kyung-hee Kim describes it as very significant. The trend is very apparent. And as we noted, it's most pronounced for kids of the younger ages in elementary school.
We'll see. We'll look at that with some kind of experts from the field. But what is it? I don't know. This 1990 data, I'm trying to figure out why that would be a sudden cliff and fall off of American creativity. I mean, everybody talks about the internet. Well, that wasn't around in 1990 to any extent. I mean, TV was around a long time before then, so that wasn't exactly new. Video
back
games,
since the 1970s, I mean, kids had been watching 3.5 hours of TV a day.
And No Child Left Behind wasn't there. Teaching to the Test wasn't there. I can't figure out why 1990 would be a turning point.
I don't think you should overly focus on what exactly happened in 1990. It's been a turn in the trajectory that's now consistently falling. So it's not like clearly in 1990 something happened. It's more like something was happening overall in our society. And to be clear, this finding that scores have been falling for the last 20 years is brand new, brand spanking new. We're reporting it last week in Newsweek for the very first time. So no one can say has studied why it's going down. But what the creativity scholarship does know are a lot of factors that influence children's creativity. And you can look at those factors and say, maybe these are factors for why scores are going down.
Let's hear some.
There are smaller ones, such as exercise, such as family styles, such as how children are allowed to play, such as the teaching styles, that's sort of the personality style of teachers. But the biggest one by far seems to be the lack of creativity development in schools itself. And we're not talking about art class. We're talking about in every class that kids are in, whether they are being challenged to generate ideas and work with those ideas to find the best result.
So the suggestion then would be that American schools were doing more of that and at some point before 1990 stopped doing as much of that?
Perhaps in combination with the amount of time kids have been spending on television and perhaps the wrong type of video games, because many video games do ask kids to come up with ideas and try things and hypothesize. And it's possible that it has to do with a playtime, undermining the kind of playtime that kids have. There is associations with, especially with role playing. Pretend play, where you adopt roles, allows a child to see things from different perspectives, and that kind of perspective taking or mentality is crucial to developing sort of creative thinking skills.
I'm still trying. I mean, you say this brand new. People haven't looked at why yet, but I'm trying to think what would the watershed have been in American culture that would have come for this to be true, would have come, let's say, in the 80s, that could produce such a change. Or maybe it was over a longer time, but I mean, did schools, I don't know, subtract some kind of creativity development curriculum broadly around the country? What could have happened?
We're in the area of speculation here. I want to be clear. And, I don't think we exactly know. I've been looking at it as Ashley, my co-author, and I have been looking at it for several months now as Dr. Kyung-hee Kim. It's not clear what to point the finger at. What is clear, Tom, is what we can do that does improve children's creativity scores. And, I'm not so worried about what caused the problem if we know what one of the good solutions is, which is problem-based learning, module-based learning, where kids are pushed to do as much divergent thinking and convergent thinking. And the important thing here is that a lot of teachers would say, look, we're inundated with these modern curriculum requirements. The kids have so much we have to teach them. There's no time for sort of creativity class in the school day. And the scholars say that that's a false trade-off, that it's not about not learning facts, because facts and research are a crucial part of creativity. It's what you do before and after you learn this sort of bolus of factual information. You generate natural curious questions about the topic and then refine those questions to become the one most important question as children you really want answered about a topic.
Can a country,
and then you study the topic.
Yeah, I mean, I've never heard of creativity class. We'll look at that and how you integrate, or I mean, you're saying you don't teach that. But I mean, I wonder if countries don't just have creativity in their DNA. I mean, this country celebrated all kinds of inventions and developments and creative ways of getting at, you name it, all kinds of problems for decades and decades and decades. I mean, can that really go away? Is not just sort of baked in the cake culturally?
I agree with you, Tom, and I think most of the scholars agree with you. Most of the scholars would say that American culture is bar none the culture that nourishes and nurtures creativity. You know, this is the best and easiest place where one can start a company or have an idea or come up with a song and put it online and become famous. Whatever creative output is going to find, this is a place where our culture sustains that. The question is whether our education system is working in concert or working against that cultural advantage. And the concern here, if we look across globally, in China, in Korea, Japan, the United Kingdom in particular, and the European Union, country after country has not left it to chance which kids become creative. They are reforming their curriculum rapidly and drastically to get away from the drill and kill type of curriculum style and get into problem-based learning, where kids are working on from inquiry. They're young inventors. They're researchers in the classroom. They're motivated. They're self-directed, and they're studying projects on sort of month-long modules. Month after month, and they're seeing great results from that. And we have some schools like that here in the United States, which we can talk about too.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about kids' creativity and America's future. A new study warns young Americans may be losing their creative edge. Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman have written it up for Newsweek. The Creativity Crisis is the headline the editors there have put on it. Poe Bronson joins us today from San Francisco. Poe, lots of reaction to this online. Here's Rachel, who says, hours and hours of homework piled on kids. Add to that video games, texting, online surfing, television. When is there time to be creative and think for one's self? Jean writes, as a parent educator, I see this complex problem, she says, as having a simple answer: allow children to daydream. Innovators of past generations were not fed streams of what and how to think. What do you make of those two first responses, Poe?
So for a long time, Tom, there was a phenomenon called the fourth grade slump. Paul Torrens called it that. And then there's a lot of analysis, well, this was sixth grade or was this third grade. But the basic idea is that in the earliest grades of elementary school, kids can sort of be creative in the abstract without relying on research and knowledge and all the facts that are filled their head. But it's around fourth grade that creativity can no longer be in a vacuum. You research and fact-finding and learning things and then working with what you've learned in a creative way is essential to further creativity. So there is, to some extent, a dynamic. The fourth grade slump, one way of explaining it, perhaps, is that jamming so much new facts into kids' head, because now they can read for comprehension, mm-hmm. and now they can compute for math. So now we can give them all this information in every class, and that it overwhelms them, and they sort of can't be creative because they're so busy memorizing and fact-finding. And if you took that into a larger perspective, there, as Rachel and Jean are mm-hmm. emailing in here, exactly to the point, which is that the kids are overwhelmed with jamming things into their head that they can't then be flexible and elaborate on those things that they've learned.
But, I mean, can't you learn a lot and be creative? I mean, isn't that
and you must. You get the hang of it over time. Over time, you develop the mental processes to work with this information, sort of to return to your creative self. But because that's why it's a temporary slump for most kids, and then they get the hang of it again. So this perhaps could be something to point to. It's not clear.
We're going to expand our conversation. Let's get to a caller or two first. Andrew in Boston. What do you think, Andrew?
Hey, what's shaking, Tom?
Oh, it's all shaking. What do you see on the creativity front?
Well, I think a big part of this pertains to the Cold War. I think that's something that hasn't really been discussed here. Following the launch of Sputnik, this country put more money than ever before into education when adjusted for inflation before. And you're talking about data from the very early 90s, and what do we see? The fall of the Iron Curtain. People in this country were very concerned about making sure that our second graders were as good at math and chess and science as the Russian third graders, or second graders. And I think when we lacked a world power competitor, we maybe let our kids off the hook. Our educational system slipped up a little.
What about now, Andrew? We've got plenty of world-scale competitors now. China, India, right on down the line?
Well, I think Chinese culture, as your guest pointed out, American culture is unique in the way that it allows creativity and that it fosters individuality in a way that I think a lot of Eastern cultures don't. But I do think, as far as our educational system goes, I do take solace in the increasing assertiveness of Russian regional hegemony. I think guys like Vladimir Putin help increase the chances of another Cold War. And I think that might do wonders for our educational system.
Bring back the Cold War to bring back creativity. We hope not, but I appreciate your call very much, Andrew. Post standby. I want to bring James Kaufman into this conversation. He joins us from San Bernardino, California, professor of psychology, director of the Learning Research Institute at California State University at San Bernardino, author of Creativity 101. James Kaufman, thank you very much for joining us.
You bet. Thank you.
We want to get to your thoughts, but first just to our caller's observation. You know, the space race, Sputnik and all that, it did indeed kick off a whole lot of attention to education in this country and maybe creative thinking to put a man on the moon and much more. Do you think you can look at the end of the Cold War and say, well, there you go, there's what pulled the plug on American creativity generation, James?
Not really, because it's not like there are no other foreign issues where we are in competition.
I mean, well, we didn't see those in 1990, though, when Poe is saying that things fell off a cliff. I mean, in 1990, it looked like, you know, the end of history and all that. We were clear sailing.
But you would also think that after 9/11, we'd see a large rise in creativity, which hasn't been shown.
What do you think's going on here? First of all, do you buy the research that Kyung-hee Kim has done here? Do you buy the assertion that, you know, the numbers show, the Torrance test scores show that we're sort of losing a generation of creativity?
I think it's certainly premature to declare a crisis. The article's still unpublished. I myself have not read it. I do know her work, which is outstanding. But it's also all based on one test, the Torrance tests, mm-hmm. which are indeed the most popular creativity tests, but are not 100% accepted by creativity researchers. In fact, they're really quite controversial about whether or not they're still relevant. One of the biggest problems is that they treat creativity as basically one thing, as being domain general, where either it's verbal or it's figural.
Right.
Whereas most of the more recent research says you can be creative in any way. You can be creative playing in your backyard with your dog. You can be creative building things out of popsicle sticks.
So is it possible that the Torrance test is just missing a new strain or breed of creativity, that it just looks different these days, and the test isn't picking up on that?
Absolutely. If you look at the amount of new ways to be creative. I mean, what are the really creative kids doing right now? Are they necessarily drawing or writing, or are they shooting YouTube videos and uploading them to the web? Things have changed. And whether the Torrance tests are still the very best way to measure creativity is up for debate. I mean, certainly they are good. The basic ideas in this study are certainly worth exploring. But I think before we can generalize to there being a real creativity crisis and exploring what happened in 1990 to change it, I think we need to see this replicated with different measures and make sure we're not just getting worried over a very specific type of finding.
Paul Bronson, how about that? Before we scare ourselves silly here and smear a whole young generation of Americans, maybe we better be careful.
Well, as every listener heard me say at the top, this is one study, the only study of its kind. We tremendously respect James Kaufman's work, and obviously interviewed him at great length for this story. Mm-hmm. And as he says, there are other ways of not quite standardized test ways as the Torrances of measuring creativity, but this is what we have to look at. I do want to say some of James' comments. Creativity, the accepted definition is that it's production of something both original and useful to a given social context.
Okay.
And it's the notion of usefulness that perhaps if I look at the history of creativity theory, where sort of creativity was on the right side of the brain, creativity is divergent thinking alone, that perhaps overlooked at the associative and not looked at sort of the vertical, the sort of honing your idea to be useful. And certainly kids play with popsicle sticks today. Some would say they don't play with popsicle sticks in the backyard nearly as much as they used to. But what we're looking for is the production of something that's both playful, original, and useful.
Is Picasso not creative because it's not useful? I don't know if it's not useful.
Picasso, by all means, was someone who, the given social context of the art world at the time, his work, not only stood the test of time, but it was perceived correctly so, because as an art history scholar myself, as both innovative and apropos and pushing the borders in just the right way and opening our eyes in just the right way.
Maybe useful commentary with Guernica or useful in helping us see the world in new ways. James Kaufman, do you think we have a creativity problem in this country, whether or not it's a fall off in 1990, James?
Absolutely. And I think you make some very important points. I think that one thing I would like to kind of add to that, given that we're now talking about Picasso, is what are we talking about when we mean creativity? Do we mean, is America producing less Picassos, or do we mean our kids being less creative in school? Because they're very different things. And I think that one thing that occurred to me just in listening to you, Poe, and just kind of thinking about this, is it almost feels like there might be some type of split where you have the kids who are passive users of the internet and of video games, and who maybe are behind any possible creative decline, but you have another stream of kids who are active users, who are much more creative than they ever could have been, who are using these tools, you know, who can shoot a movie on their iPhone and then edit it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if it isn't a matter of whatever the overall trend is, there's a lot of noise in there, and that we need to be clear about who should we be trying to reach. Should we be, for example, if we're worried about what's sometimes called Big C or genius creativity, do we need to be increasing MacArthur Genius Grants or in some way focusing on that? If we're worried about kids, obviously we would focus on school.
Let me get a call right here from Kevin, Randolph, Massachusetts. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm 53. I guess I'm right around your ballpark.
Yes, you are.
Yes. You and I grew up in a much simpler time, obviously. And I think what's missing to a significant extent in today's world is the simple art of self-talk. Everything that you and I did when we were young people, or all our lives, if it didn't involve actually being with another person, we were alone. We were alone with our thoughts. We didn't have an MP3 player. We didn't even have a Walkman. If we had to walk down the corner store for an ice cream cone and walk back, we were alone with our thoughts to think and to wonder. I became a liberal. I didn't become a liberal because of anything I learned in school. I became a liberal because of the conversations I had with myself as I walked to my buddy's house and back the mile from my buddy's house. And that's what we all did. We became atheists, or we embraced our religions that we were brought up with. during the moments that we were alone, not in school, not in front of a screen, not with earbuds in our ears, blasting music or telling us what to think.
Kevin, it's very interesting. Let us pick that up. You clearly had a different voice in your head than, I don't know, Rush Limbaugh or Glenn Beck. But anybody who looks at kids these days will think about the diminished amount of time that, as you put it, they're alone with their thoughts. James Kaufman, it's your field. Is that a big deal to you? Is that related to creativity or the absence of creativity? Could it be?
Certainly rumination is related to creativity. People who ruminate more and who think more about things will often be more creative. And certainly some studies have found that it goes beyond just creativity, you know, obviously, and that people who journal or blog or do something that gets them in touch with their thoughts on a regular basis are also more happy and more healthy.
So is an earbud generation, you know, with the BlackBerry or iPhone or whatever, you know, welded to the end of its hand, is that facing an uphill headwind on creativity or not?
Certainly, I think that it's part of a much larger issue of children being protected, children being never bored. I think that as a society, we've become both overprotective and terrified of our kids being bored or acting out. It used to be that, you know, there was more of this feeling of, you know, it takes a village to raise a child, and a kid slightly acting out in public or on an airplane would be treated with more sympathy. Now, kids just aren't welcome most places in terms of that most adults go. I think that we've, in general, the lawsuits, the safety issues, kids need to explore. They need to fail. They need to get hurt. You get insight and creativity with mistakes.
Let them play. Let them ruminate. Let them make mistakes. Let's get a call from New York City. Matt, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm just calling because I had a comment about the argument that creativity is suffering because of an overemphasis on memorization of facts in our schools.
Drill and kill, Poe Bronson said. Drill and kill, yeah.
Exactly. I am always sort of aghast when I hear that argument because, you know, our education system in this country is really suffering and actually failing in comparison to a lot of other countries in the world because there's not enough emphasis on memorization of facts. And actually, the idea that drill and kill rules our schools is really a myth. Really, the prevailing educational theory in this country is don't force kids to memorize facts because it'll hurt their creativity. And where that's gotten us is we have a failing education system and still apparently don't have, you know, still we're failing at creativity too. So I really think that argument really hurt our education system and hasn't really seemed to benefit creativity anyway.
It's pretty appalling to think we could lose in both of those categories. Poe Bronson, how about that observation?
Well, to be clear, the scholars are not saying don't teach kids facts, don't have kids do research. That is not what they are saying. They are saying that's a vital part of creative theory and creative thinking skills. It's about not memorizing things in the absence of a natural curiosity and question-driven inquiry. So kids should, rather than just say, we want to learn everything there is about sound acoustics because we're in a fifth-grade curriculum class, what questions do you want to know about sound? What are all the questions you can think of? And then let's come up with one question that we think we will hold on to while we study sound acoustics. And now, as the listeners, all the adult listeners to this show, when we do our jobs, when we work, and if we're working with information, we comb through lots and lots of knowledge looking for things that are relevant to our inquiry. And there's a very difference between just memorize all the facts versus work through all of the material searching for what's relevant. And that process of understanding what's relevant is a crucial cognitive skill that's important for intelligence, important for creativity, important for everything.
James Kaufman, we just got half a minute before the break, but can we not have it both ways? That is, very well-educated young Americans who, you know the facts they need to know to be the building blocks, but who are also creative. Can we not have both?
What's interesting is that Robert Sternberg and colleagues have done research that shows that if you teach kids from a creative standpoint, they memorize and remember things better than if you emphasize rote memorization. So, in fact, the caller's point is actually almost directly opposite what everything research shows, that teaching for creativity increases rote memorization also.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about kids' creativity and America's future. A new study is coming out warning young Americans may be losing their creative edge. Poe Bronson writes it up for Newsweek magazine. The creativity crisis was the headline last week. He joins us today from San Francisco. James Kaufman is here from San Bernardino, California State University, San Bernardino, author of Creativity 101. Let's get one call right here from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Susan. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm a middle school teacher. Mm-hmm. I teach art. And one of the things, loved the conversation. It's so much for us to think about and talk about, and especially for teachers, for us to talk about this. But something I think that needs to be mentioned is the importance of modeling integrated thinking, because I think it's great for students to do convergent and divergent thinking, but if you're not integrating it, and I think there's a lot of artists whose work we can look to in terms of how they define creativity and how they literally struggled with it their entire life.
What do you mean by modeling integrative thinking, Susan?
For instance, in my middle school environment, when the social study teacher teaches about Africa, I teach a unit on creating an African clay house, and we study African architecture. And so children are not set in little subject areas. They're forced to take what they learn in each subject and kind of pool it together so it makes sense for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for instance, I think of the recent exhibit of Matisse that's now in New York.
Okay.
And when you read about his life and how he both defined creativity but how he struggled with it every day, or you think about that great novel about creativity called The Horse's Mouth, or, I mean, you think about Marcel Duchamp and his essay, The Creative Act, in which he says it's one thing for someone to be doing this creative work, but if there's no one to receive it, if there's no audience, it's the audience that defines what creativity is in terms of an artist's work. We have a lot to learn if we just open up the sources that exist. I mean, looking and reading the work of John Berger is another example of how we learn visually. And I'm not saying all creativity is visual, but I am saying that I guess the most important thing I want to say in this conversation is I'm dealing with 150 students every quarter, and I'm not worried. There's a ton of creativity. I look at the way young people are cooperatively working technologically, and maybe as you initially started your conversation and talked about maybe we just aren't measuring it correctly for today by using the tools of yesterday.
You're teaching, and you're not worried, and that is a comfort, and a comfort to have somebody with your breadth of thinking about this as a teacher there in Minneapolis. It's great, Susan. I appreciate your call. I want to bring another voice right in here, if I may, and thanks for calling in. Robert Slavin joins us from Baltimore. He's director of the Center for Research and Reform in Education at Johns Hopkins University and director of the Institute for Effective Education at the University of York in England, author of 2 Million Children, Success for All, and Educational Research in the Age of Accountability. Robert Slavin, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello.
Newsweek magazine has us worried. Susan in Minneapolis says she's teaching and she's not worried. How do you look at this issue of the sort of active level of creativity in, I guess you'd have to say, our kids or young Americans, and whether it's, you know, up, down, or backwards? Do you see a problem?
I think that there's a problem, but it's a longstanding problem, and I'm not at all convinced that that creativity is getting worse. I agree, I think, with a lot of people who have been talking about the importance of having more opportunities for kids to do things that are creative and to be encouraged for coming up with creative solutions to things in school. But I don't remember the 50s or the 60s or the 70s or the 80s as being especially creative either. And so the idea that there's that creativity is diminishing, I'd have to see a lot more evidence. There's, you know, the Torrance itself has been revised several times. The sampling, the particular kids who took the Torrance could be different than the ones who were doing it before. Lots of other possible explanations for this, what that could be correct, but it could be just a statistical blip.
Now, you're the big expert. If you don't see creativity as having been there in the 50s or 60s or 70s or 80s, I mean, are we kidding ourselves when we think about America as being the creative culture?
Well, I think I'm just talking about creativity as an emphasis in school teaching,
okay.
Which I think has been a problem for a very long time. I think that it's not that that it's all rote recitation that kids are doing, but I think that teaching for a very long time has done far too little to build children's ability to be creative. And I think that there's real good arguments for doing a lot more of it. And there were good arguments in the 60s, and the 70s, and the 80s that people weren't attending to either. I just don't see this as an immediate crisis, but I do see it as a useful emphasis for the future.
Poe Bronson, you describe an anecdote in your story of an American education scholar going to China and describing to a group of Chinese educators some of the direction of American education these days, and their reaction. I wish you'd share that with us.
Yeah, this is Jonathan Plucker. He was touring China to see their new problem-based learning schools.
This is your Indiana University problem.
Indiana University creativity theorist, yes. Mm-hmm. And then he was speaking at a major university there, and they asked him, you know, what are the trends in American education thinking? Tell us the secret, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he explains, well, we've been doing this sort of nationalized testing and standardized curriculum and emphasis on memorization. And it took a moment for this to be translated. And when it was translated, the scholars just started laughing out loud. And finally, one of them controlled their laughter and said to him, you're racing towards our old model when we're racing towards your model as fast as we can. I don't think that this could be, as Slavin is wondering, if this could be a statistical blip. I think he knows Dr. Kyung-hee Kim's work, though he hasn't seen this paper yet. He knows the excellence of her work, and it's not going to be caught off guard by just failure to norm correctly. The norming of all standardized tests are renormed regularly, and all the statistical matters are looked at very closely in this kind of an analysis.
Well, I don't know if we can solve that piece. We hear the different potential interpretations. James Kaufman, what do you make of this China anecdote? I mean, is it possible? Is there some irreconcilable tension between the move in the United States to try and make sure that kids are learning basic information and creativity? The Chinese they're laughing when we talk about national, Plucker talked about national standards that we're trying and curricula we're trying to introduce here. And he reports the Chinese laughing in response, saying they're trying to go the other way.
Jonathan's experience actually mirrors my own. Both Jonathan and I have traveled a lot to Asian countries and European countries, and we've often compared notes. And when I went to Korea, for example, on a couple of different occasions, they talked about all the funds available for creativity research and how they were trying to try these new things in the schools. I went to Qatar, and there was a whole conference on creativity talking about how can we increase creativity in the schools. And there was a certain amount of support and general belief that, yes, we need to be creative, that I found in Korea, Taiwan, Spain, Qatar, places like that, and obviously Jonathan has found in China, that generally you don't find here.
Robert Slavin, how about it? Look at China, what they're trying to do to get away from rote learning. How do you see this vis-a-vis systems and emphasis in other countries these days, Robert?
Well, I visited China as well, and I find this astonishing. The Chinese are working very hard to have a more open and creative system, but this is starting from a level of an extreme focus on rote memorization, mm-hmm. and on feeding back precisely what you've been taught. At numerous Chinese universities, I saw the phenomenon where people students would get up in the morning and sit under a tree and read their books over and over and over and over again out loud to themselves to memorize the actual words in the book.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite an extraordinary system. And I saw in the classrooms, classrooms where you had 40 and 50 kids who were just exactly mirroring back to the teacher. So there is a movement to start having things like science labs and, cooperative groups and things where kids can be more collaborative and more creative in solving problems. But because the Chinese understand that they need to do a great deal along those lines, but let's not be misled about the level from which they're beginning. To get up to the level of creativity that we had in the 50s or 60s will take the Chinese quite a while.
Let's go to Megan in New Haven, Connecticut. Megan, you're on the air.
Hi there. How are you, Tom?
Pretty well. What do you see, Megan?
I'm a senior at Yale, and I had the fortune of growing up and participating in, I don't know how common these are, but a creative thinking program called Odyssey of the Mind and similarly Destination Imagination. And I'm curious because when I got to Yale, I'm focusing in education policy.
Okay.
And I noticed that there were no similar creative thinking programs available to New Haven students in sort of inner city schools. And I'm wondering if there is, if the researchers see any correlation between class and income and levels of creativity of the current generation.
That's very interesting. Pooh, I'll come first to you from the latest research or your reporting, class, income, and creativity. What about it?
Yeah, and for Megan's particular creative thinking programs that she was in, she mentioned Odyssey of the Mind and Destination of the Imagination. Those, in large meta-analyses, come out very well as encouraging kids' creativity scores. One of the interesting things, Tom, is that creative thinking doesn't skew towards class in the same extent that IQ did. So we found one school district in part of St. Louis called University City, Missouri, a school district right next to the St. Louis University, Washington University in St. Louis, excuse me. And just this year, this last year, they did gifted and talented admittance based half on a IQ test and half on the Torrance test of creative thinking. And one of the great results of it was that not only was now the gifted and talented population 60% bigger, but it was far more diverse as a result.
Robert Slavin, what about these so-called creative thinking programs? Are they skewed toward middle or upper middle or upper class Americans? Is there a class profile to creativity in this country?
Well, unfortunately, I do think that that middle-class kids are more likely to get instruction that focuses that gives them opportunities to be creative and to really use the skills and the science and social studies, art and music skills that middle-class kids can take for granted. And I think that in many high-poverty schools, people are so concerned that the kids will score well on the state math and reading tests, that they spend a lot of time on those and just don't put the kind of emphasis on the other subjects that you'd want them to place. And so in a sense, I think we are creating more of a creativity gap than we should have in this country.
But I remember when No Child Left Behind first came on the scene, talking with some educators who said, look, this is just the sacrifice that middle, upper middle class families, kids have to make to be sure that our whole society gets basic information. What about that, Robert Slavin?
I don't know that middle class kids had to sacrifice. And, you know, there have been some gains made in areas other than creativity, such as improvements in mathematics are really quite dramatic over the last decade. And IQs continue to increase and reading increases a little tiny bit. But I don't think we're taking away from the middle class to give something to the poor, and the gap between middle class and poor kids has not diminished. So there's still a great deal to be done at all levels, but I do think that the issues of teaching more broadly than just reading and math are problematic in middle class, but very problematic in high poverty schools.
Lynn in Charlestown, Massachusetts. Lynn, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for having me on. I taught for 3 years at an urban high school outside of Boston, and I'm currently a writing professor in an urban community college.
Okay.
And I think that a very important related issue, in addition to lack of creativity, is that what I see in my students is a diminishment of critical thinking skills. And I feel that you need the critical thinking skills in order to be creative in the first place. And I, you know, I mean, they're bombarded with so much information that they don't know how to evaluate what is valid.
So what do they need? Less information, more support in developing critical thinking skills? What's the answer?
Someone earlier was talking about, one of your earlier callers was talking about time for rumination, and I think they do need to take the earbuds out of their ears and be alone with their thoughts, and that's one of the things that I try to develop as a writing professor, and that is to journal. Write your thoughts, be reflective. And, you know, it sounds very easy, but it's a very difficult thing to do and to get them to focus for the most part.
With everything going on today, Lynn, thanks for your call. James Kaufman, if you could wave a wand and make changes either in our culture or our education system to bump up creativity today, what would you first focus on, James?
Certainly, a lot of what I would focus on is actually tying into the last point, which I was hoping you'd ask me to comment on, because, in fact, if you look at the creativity gap, African-Americans often do better than Caucasians on tasks of creativity, whether actual tasks or divergent thinking. Mm. Scores on creativity are the flip side of IQ scores. And so...
how do you explain that?
I think part of it is values, culture. I think that by measuring the GREs and the SATs, we are measuring a tiny fraction of people's intellectual abilities. By leaving out creativity, we are hurting specific groups in this country, also including people who are strong in creativity, you know, and people who maybe don't do well on tests. If I could do one thing, it would be to increase the presence of creativity in how we help out kids, how we get kids into good schools, how we hire people, to increase that as being a possible selector for people getting better services and better opportunities.
It can sound soft and kind of ineffable, and yet we know at the end of the day it may be the most important thing, whether it's in politics or the economy or certainly technology, right across the whole range. Paul Bronson, we're grateful to you for bringing the subject to our attention in Newsweek, and it's great to have you back with us today. Thanks so much for joining us, Paul.
Thank you, Tom.
Paul Bronson, co-author of The Creativity Crisis in Newsweek. Robert Slavin at Johns Hopkins University, thank you very much for your time and thoughts today.
Glad to do it.
And James Kaufman in San Bernardino, thanks for joining us, James.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for your time today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.